It was a hazy afternoon in Tokyo. Mid-afternoon, the commuter train was about half full. Few early commuters, few late afternoon shoppers. And suddenly, this tranquil atmosphere was shattered by this bellicose voice cursing almost incomprehensible invectives. And the door to the train slammed open, and this big guy staggered in. And he was huge, and he was dirty, and he was drunk. And he just sneered at everyone. There was a woman holding a small child standing near the door, and he swung at them with the back of his hand and sent them spinning into the lap of an elderly couple. It's a miracle no one was hurt. And then he, all the people got up and ran to the back of the train when he did that, and so he kicked at their backs as they ran away. And when he missed, he got so angry that he reached down and tried to rip one of the seats off the floor. And in the process of doing that, he cut his hand, and it was bleeding and dripping on the floor. And at that point, the train door slammed shut, and the train car lurched as it started to roll out of the station. And everyone froze. They were trapped with this maniac. Also on the train that afternoon was a man by the name of Terry Dobson. Do any of you know of Terry Dobson? Yeah. After that, he lived in the Boston area for a while, died just a few years ago. But this was many, many years ago, and he'd been in Tokyo studying Aikido. He'd been working out for 8 hours a day for 3 years. And he thought of himself as pretty good. And he loved to grapple. Really enjoyed it. But his one discontent was that his martial skills had never been tried in real combat. Because as a student of the martial art, he wasn't allowed to fight. His teacher would say to him, he who has the mind to defeat another has broken his connection with law, with life. He's already lost. So in Aikido, we study how to resolve conflicts, not how to start them. Well, Terry was young, but he listened to his sensei. He respected him a lot, and he tried hard to follow this guidance. He went so far as to cross the street when he was walking down to the train station to avoid the street punks that hung out on the other side. He felt exalted in his forbearance. He felt tough and holy. But deep in his heart of hearts, he wanted the absolutely legitimate excuse to defend the innocent by destroying the wicked. This is it, he thought, as he sat there in that train car. If I don't do something soon, somebody's going to get hurt. So he stood up very slowly and just took hold of one of the commuter straps up there. And he looked at the big drunk and gave him this long look of disgust and dismissal. He was going to take this turkey apart. But from Terry's perspective, the big drunk had to make the first move. And Terry wanted him good and mad. So he pursed his lips and blew him an insolent kiss. Oh, all right, big drunk said. He saw an opportunity to focus all his rage. I'm going to give you a lesson in manners. And he gathered himself, and just as he was about to rush, there was this voice. It was piercing. Hey! High-pitched, piercing, but had this strangely lilting quality to it. It's like you and a friend had been looking around for something that you lost, something very precious, and you looked and you looked and you looked, and you finally came upon it. Hey! The big drunk turned to his right, and Terry turned to his left, and there sitting on one of the benches was this elderly Japanese gentleman dressed immaculately in a coat and a tie. And he was just beaming delightedly up at the big drunk. Come here, he said. Come here, I want to talk to you.
talk in an easy vernacular. Well, the big drunk, as if he was pulled on a string, staggered over and planted his feet in front of this little man and said, "Why the heck should I talk to you?" Spittle sprayed all over the little man. There was Terry looking at the back of his drunk, and he said, "If he takes one more step towards that little man, I'm going to drop him in his socks."
"What you been drinking?"
He just beamed with delight and interest. "I've been drinking sake, and it's none of your damn business."
"Oh, that's wonderful, that's wonderful. You know, I like sake too. Me and my wife, she's 86, you know. Every night we take a little glass of sake and we go out and sit on the bench that my grandfather made. And we sit and drink our sake and watch the sun go down. And we like to see how our persimmons tree is doing. We worry about it, you know, with all this bad weather we've had. It's actually done quite well when you consider the quality of the soil. It's so lovely, just sitting there, me and my wife, drinking our sake as the sun goes down."
Big drunk's hands began to unclench a little bit as he struggled to follow the little man's conversation. He finally said, "Yeah, I like persimmons too." And then his voice kind of trailed off in confusion.
"Oh, and I bet you have a lovely wife too."
"Nah, she died." And very slowly he began to rock back and forth with the movement of the train car. "I ain't got no wife. I ain't got no job. I ain't got no home. I feel so ashamed." And these ripples of despair just welled up through him as these tears running down his face. Terry began to feel dirtier than the drunk. So he stood there in his righteousness, make the world safe from terrorists. But by this time, the train was getting into the station where Terry usually got off, so he turned to leave. And as he walked off the train, he looked back, and that was the big drunk, sprawled out on the seat. The little man had said, "Come here, I need to talk to you." Big drunk had just lay down on his back with his head on the old man's lap, who was stroking his filthy matted hair. A couple minutes later, Terry was standing on the platform there, watching the train rattle off into the distance. And he thought, "At last I've seen Aikido tried in actual combat." And the essence of it is kindness. So, tonight, I'd like to reflect on, as I said earlier, on the hindrances, obstacles, the stuff that comes up that seems to throw us off balance. If we see these as a problem, then like Terry, then we've got something we've got to fix or defeat or overcome or transcend or something. We've got a problem to deal with. But if we look at these with the kindness of this elderly gentleman, then they cease to be a problem. They cease to be a problem. They'll either dissolve or sometimes they just come right up to us and put their head on our lap. But they cease to be a problem. So tonight I want to talk about three different views of hindrances and obstacles and demons. I want to look at them as crossed intentions, and then we'll look at them as spiritual trainers, and then we'll look at them as a split between self and other. But before we do that, I would just pose the question. I think I have it on here. Yeah, what's the problem with these metaphorical demons, hindrances, hang-ups, worries, angst, melancholy?
why should we be concerned with them at all? I think I put the answer in there, didn't I? Yes. The difficulty with them is that they actually distort our consciousness. It's like we have clear awareness. There are things that we're looking at with this awareness, and we're looking through the qualities in our mind, heart. And if there's tension, anger, yearning, aversion in the mind, heart, then our perception is distorted. And our thinking gets distorted, and our decisions get distorted. So, some of the classical names for these distortions have been things like, defilement, cankers, taints, effluences. They kind of muddy the mind, heart. But the distortion itself, the tightness in the mind, is actually a very innocent biological response. You know, it's a big drunk. He wasn't evil. He's just a broken heart. So I prefer to give these just the name distortion and kind of get the moral labels off of them. Just look them as distortions. So what hindrances are is they are a phenomena that shows us where there is some kind of distortion in our system, where there's something that's out of balance. The Pali term for hindrance, nivarana, literally means a covering, sometimes translated as a veil. So the hindrances cover some truth, some wisdom, something that would be very helpful for us. So that's the bad news. But it's also the good news, because it shows us right where it is. It's right under that cover. We just have to figure out how to lift the cover. So my preferred method is the one that I alluded to earlier, and that you see in the first circle here, that I affectionately call the six R's. I know some of you are familiar with this. It's that when you look at a hindrance, rather than it being something to defeat or fix, the first thing is just to see what it is, recognize it, to release it, let it be. Relax the tension. Bring uplifted states in. Simple way to do that is just to smile. It can be in your lips, it can be in the eyes, it can be in your heart. And then you bring that back to your object of meditation. And that will tend to actually melt and allow the hindrances to actually dissolve on their own. See, if you put a lot of energy into getting rid of them, it just reinforces them on some level. And I put the second circle on there because in off the cushion, out in life, all this stuff comes up. And when you're meditating, a big disturbance comes up, there's basically nothing to do about it. You just see it, you know, when you keep meditating. But when you're out walking around your life, in your life, you know, if you see some big guy yelling at a little kid, well, you know, maybe there's something for you to do there. You know, there's lots of situations where those of us who are not monastics, which I think includes all of us, who are committed to living engaged lives in the world, there are sometimes things we have to do. But we don't want to respond to those from a tight, tense mind. So there's the six R's in meditation, then the seven R's, recognize, release, relax, re-smile. So you get to a brighter, lighter quality of mind, heart, and then from there you reflect on the situation. And then you respond. A lot of us kind of respond first and think about it later. So this is trying to just create a little bit of space in there to come from a deeper wisdom. And in meditation and in life, you know, when you're arguing with somebody, if in the midst of that, maybe you just let the argument go on and you just notice the tension inside, the anger inside you, and allow that tension to soften a little bit. Sometimes a little more wisdom comes in and clears. But not always.
So what I want to really focus in on tonight is that it's that 5 or 10% of the time where, and you probably know this from meditation, where there's something that comes up and you deal with it and it comes back and it comes back and it comes back and sometimes it gets stronger. It just ain't going away. So what do we do then? There is this sutta that I wanted to spend some time with, but we're not going to have time to get to it. But I love the phrase that the Buddha uses. It's so I've got it here. Basically, he says that to Anuruddha, he says, you should investigate that. You know, if there's something that gets stuck, you should investigate that a little bit. And in the six R's, what that means is actually spend more time with a recognition. So, and if you spend a little more time with recognition, one of the things that you'll notice sometimes is that you've got mixed intentions. It's pretty rare that any of us do anything with just one intention alone. Terry wanted to be a peaceful student of Aikido, and he also wanted an excuse to beat the tar out of somebody. Mm-hmm. A lot of us have. You're sitting there in meditation, or you're walking through the woods, or you're riding the light rail in the work, and your mind keeps on going over and over and over this fight you had with your boss or your partner or your teenager. And what you say to yourself is, you know, I just really want to be peaceful. I just want to let that go. It's not a big deal. I just want to quiet, you know. And it keeps coming back. And if you look deeper, what you may see is there may be some part of you that would like to win the fight next time. And wants to have a well-honed retort, you know, that's all in the chamber and ready to fire if it comes up again. What else? What are some other examples of mixed intentions? You have a project at work that you have to get done, and you're really trying to stay focused, and you find yourself just kind of slipping off, thinking about the vacation that's coming up. Now, I want to get this work done. Well, there's some part of you that enjoys the fantasy. So you all have these mixed intentions, and oftentimes there are some of those intentions that are legitimate in our minds, and others that aren't. Particularly if there's a little bit of malice, you know, a little bit of a place that wouldn't literally do this, but some place inside that would just like to scratch an eye out. You know? And what happens is that hindrance will keep coming back until you see it. I brought this. I wish we had more time. Does anybody know this book? There's No Such Thing as a Dragon. Mm-hmm. It's just wonderful. I really recommend it. It's a sutta. What happens is Billy wakes up in the morning, and there's this little dragon about the size of a little kitten sitting on the foot of his bed. And he runs down there and says, Mom, there's a dragon upstairs. And she says, there's no such thing as a dragon. So she says, well, okay. And in the next picture, he's sitting there eating his breakfast, and mother is making something over there. And the dragon now is the size of a small dog, sitting in the middle of the table, eating his pancakes. And he says, Mom, the dragon's eating the pancakes. And Mom says, there's no such thing as a dragon. So I go, oh, okay. So you go on, and there's all these scenes where he goes off to school, and now the dragon is the size of a couple of horses, and mother is trying to clean up the house and stuff and having to crawl out the window to get on the other side, but still thinking there's no such thing as dragons. Well, the dragon gets so big that it stands up and lifts the whole house and walks off down the street. And then there is this lovely scene here where father comes home for lunch, and he's standing on the stoop, and there is just this empty foundation, and it says, When Mr. Bixby came home for lunch, the first thing he noticed was the house was gone. Luckily, one of the neighbors was able to tell him which way it went. So he goes off, you know, and they finally, you know, finds his house and this dragon, and he says, what happened? And Billy says, it was the dragon. And Mother says, there's no such thing as a dragon. And Billy says, yes, there is, and it's right here. And he pats it on the head. And the dragon starts to shrink a little bit. And he strokes it some more and gets smaller and smaller and smaller until it's back the size of a kitten. And at the very end, they're sitting there, Mother's sitting there with this stroking this baby dragon in his lap, and she says, I don't mind dragons this size. Why did it have to grow so big? I'm not sure, said Billy, but I think it just wanted to be noticed. Hindrances want to be noticed. Utejaneas, Burmese monk, the way he says it, he says, hindrances never come in through the front door. Hindrances stay alive, you know, have to come in the side. If you see them straight on and clear awareness without judgment, just see them, the tension starts to drain out of them and they dissolve slowly. So if you find yourself really dogged by something that comes up over and over and over, and you can't figure out how to deal with it. I mean, I would sit there and say, I will be peaceful, I will just see it, I won't try to get rid of it because I know that will get rid of it. You know that place? And it doesn't work, of course. So if you find yourself with one of those, just spend a little time and see if there is some part of you that actually wants to have that there. And then you can 6R that. And then the whole thing will start to come apart. Okay. Any thoughts or questions, responses before I move on to the next one? Okay. So, what happens is, as they start to dissolve like that, you begin to see, as I mentioned earlier, they really are more like trainers and friends. In Buddha's map, when I was talking about them, I started off talking about Kali Durga. Any of you know from Hinduism, Kali Durga? Kali Durga is usually presented as kind of a Medusa's Medusa. You know, snakes for hair and skulls and necklace and fangs and blood coming out of her teeth and on and on and on. It's really horrible. Well, it turns out that Kali really loves to devour impurities. And so if you really want to get clean, if you want to get purified, this is from a Hindu perspective, you can invite Kali in and she will devour them all for you. But if there's some part of you that wants to hang on to them a little bit, she doesn't mind devouring you at the same time. So that's a little heavy for a Buddhist temperament. But if you take this this notion of hindrances, nivarana, as coverings, show us where their attention is, then they actually become spiritual trainers. Because they are very finely tuned to you. You know, they will show you where your difficulties are. I had a spiritual trainer at the gym a couple of years ago for a while. And it was really great. And he could show me all kinds of things to do. But of course, he couldn't do them for me. So the hindrances will show us where our work is, but they're not going to do the work for us. However, if hindrances are spiritual trainers, you may have noticed that they all have Asperger's. Right? They are clueless as to social signals. Right? You can be all worn out after a long week, and it's like, okay, I just need a break from all this stuff. And your spiritual trainer says, well, you know, you really are stuck in this place and you really need to look at it. Look, I just, you know, leave it be for a little. No, but it's there. You know, it's like they don't even hear. They have no idea about personalities or your peeves or stuff like that. They just show you. And so if you fight them, it feels like they're rubbing your nose in the dirt. But if you think about it, who's a better friend? Someone who says you're wonderful when you're really full of it, you know? Or someone who says, look, you're really out of balance here, you know, when you are. So they are, they're idiot savants. You know, they're really very, very good at pointing out where we need to bring some more heartful, relaxed, open, clear awareness. And if you fight him, it's awful. Okay. So, we've looked at hindrances, crossed intentions, and we've looked at them as trainers. The last way I want to look at them is the one that goes the deepest, and it's the trickiest one to look at, but it is to see hindrances as basically being, at the core what they are, is a split between self and other. Split between self and other. And to see this, I'd like to go through what I consider the genealogy of hindrances. You know, in the Bible, they talk about, you know, these people, and they beget these people, and these beget these ones, and they talk about all these generations. Well, hindrances have this kind of genealogy. So, what is the absolute source, the mother goddess, the beginning of all hindrances, all of them?
Ignorance?
Before ignorance.
A permanent abiding self?
Even before that. The Pali word for it sounds like a trumpet flourish.
Reflective tightness.
Tana. Which is this biological tightness. So what happens is we're sitting there completely mellow, and there's just a flow of experience. And a little bit of tightness comes into that. And the first thing that tightness does is it starts to divide our experience into this is me, this experience is not me. This is mine, this is not mine. This is who I am, this is not who I am. Before there's any tension, there's not that distinction, they're just phenomena that are going through there. A little bit of tension, they start to divide into self and other. And this is so, so deeply wired into us. And so familiar that it just happens without most of us, you know, ever really seeing it. But the Buddha offered this, what I think was a meditative practice. So you know this phrase, you know, this is me, this is mine, this is myself, this is not me, this is mine, this is not myself. If you study the suttas, you find that in there a lot. And I think this was actually posed as a question. So if you're meditating or if you're out walking around your life and there's some difficulty come up, you can ask yourself this very simple question. Is this me? Is this mine? Is this not me? You know, so you're sitting there and so one of my favorite hindrances is worry. You know, I can be sitting there quietly, and the worry will come up. And then what it does is very quickly is it goes out and it tries to find something that it can be worried about. And we live in a world that will give us lots and lots of props. And what we think has happened is something happens in the world, and therefore we get worried. But when I'm really quiet and look at it, see the worry comes up first. If I can see the worry come up, it's this interesting question, is this me? And does that worry me? It seems like it when it gets caught out there. But if I'm just sitting in a mellow place and this worry starts to come up, you know, it's not really clear where that's coming from. It's just a phenomena. But as it grabs hold, there's me that's worried about that. You know? We want something, we don't want something, we don't want to deal with something. There's some tension that splits that apart. Do you know that it's a very famous quartet, Dogen? To study the way is to study the self. It's this whole path, what the whole path is about is just looking to see what the self is. To study the self is to lose the self. To lose the self is to be enlightened by all things. To be enlightened by all things is to remove the barrier between self and other. Does this make sense? I think we did this exercise here a while ago, but I think it's very helpful. If we can take just a moment, and I would invite you to relax and let your awareness come inside and see where your sense of self seems to reside. So, for example, you know, we have these bodies. We think it's in our body, but, you know, our feet seem to be down there. You know, our knees are down. The crown of our head is up. So where is this self located in this whole energetic system? See if you can find a place where there's just this sense of it's from here that you look out on the world, here where you hear sounds, here where you look at even your body, and see where that seems to reside. Where is its center point, center place? This is very subtle, so if you don't see it, it's okay. But I just want to see. So how many of you have a sense of that? And where does it seem to reside?
I feel like it's in my brain.
In the brain. Some people it seems like it's down here in the West. It's more often up here. So if you can get a sense of wherever that is, and then see if you can just allow it to soften. We think it's permanent and abiding, but just invite it to soften. And see what happens. So what happens for you?
It kind of dissolves.
Yeah, it kind of dissolves.
Like it's not as, I mean, when you first asked us to find it, it had a lot to do with like kind of the tension of it.
Right.
It was here for me.
Mm-hmm.
But then when you physically or intentionally try to soften it, for me, it just, like, wait, where did it go?
Yeah. And then how do you feel in the wake of it? If I can ask.
I guess a little bit confused.
Yeah. So that's what happens most. It gets just a little spacey. Because... You know? We're actually used to it. It's like this sort of anchor place that's there all the time. You don't even think, you know, it seems to be permanent, and yet it can soften. And then it's like, you're not quite sure how to navigate anymore. But it's also a little bit lighter, probably, unless it gets scary. But don't worry, you can get it back. No problem, it's well practiced. Okay. So, starts with tana, this reflexive tightening, and the tana begets two children, self and other. And if you can relax that, then it dissolves. If you don't relax that, then they beget three children. And those children are
on your cheat sheet, I think.
Greed, hatred, and delusion.
Right. It's classical greed, hatred, and delusion. Wanting, aversion, ignorance. Called lots of different things. What did I call them? Oh, that's good. It's not even on there, but you got it. So I really like to use the Pali terms lobha, dosa, and moha because they're very broad. You know, greed has a kind of a huge charge around it, but just a very subtle pining for something that also has that sort of grasping quality. So lobha is this quality of mind, heart to kind of move towards things or wants to pull things towards it. And it can be ravenous and it can be very gentle. Dosa pushes away, or is anger, can be ferocious. And moha is the confusion. And the confusion can run everything from, you know, a psychotic break to just have bad information. You know, somehow you're not seeing things clearly. And I also like them because I think they were the precursors to Larry Curly and Moe. That's what they remind me of. And they're like that. You know, the Three Stooges were caused a lot of problems, you know, caused a lot of pain, a lot of confusion, all kinds of stuff, but they were basically innocent, you know, at heart. And greed, hatred, and delusion are really innocent. You know, they're just doing their stuff. So, lobha, dosa, moha, if we relax those, then we're fine. We're back to clear awareness. If not, they beget five children. And they are, you want to just name one of them? Doubt. Sloth and torpor. Oh, it's my old favorite. Mm-hmm.
Restlessness.
Restlessness. Yeah.
Aversion.
Desire.
Pardon?
Desire.
And desire. Right. So those are the five classical hindrances that we hear. And I came up with this little genealogy because I was trying to figure out all these pieces fit together. And that's how I think they happen. Does everybody know what sloth and torpor are? So torpor is a kind of a fuzziness of mind, tiredness, and then sloth is the place that says, I should 6-hour that, I'll do that in a few minutes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So sloth is like your motivation, you know, for your practice is shot, and those tend to arise together. And there is a lot that's made of these, I call them the big five, because they show up for a lot of people. But they're just representative of the pantheon and tendencies. And so, you know, if you 6-hour these, if you find ways to skillfully relax them, they will evaporate. If you don't, then they go out and they multiply and populate the world. And that's where we are with, you know, this vast range of all kinds of hindrances that all have within it, you know, at the very core, some tightening. And if you can see your way to that, and it takes the kindness of that gentleman to do it. I'm going to see it so I can get rid of it. Well, you can feel the tension in that already. Let me just say one other thing about the tension. There's this, I think it's a pretty universal principle of how the mind heart operates, which is that we get what we put our energy into. We get what we put our energy into. So if you want an ice cream cone, and you put a lot of energy into an ice cream cone, you may or may not get the ice cream cone, because there's lots of external causes and conditions you don't know. But what you will get is wanting, because that's what you're putting your energy into.
Right? That's the energy that's flowing through your neural network, through your system, and gets imprinted. So if, so that will go into your system. If you have a lot of aversion, you know, you want to get rid of this guy who talks too much or whatever it is, maybe you'll get rid of him, maybe you won't, but you will get aversion built into your system. And another word for this is karma, right? Because it kind of puts a leaning into us. So if you spend a lot of time wanting things, you have this, you develop a system that you're living in that's very good at wanting. And it's like I was talking about the worry, you know, if you satisfy that, the wanting can be so active, it'll go out and find something else and something else and something else until we can actually look at the tension itself. And karma is not fate. It gets confused with Western fate. Karma just means there's a strong leaning. And if we're not aware of it, if we're not watching it, then it's like dominoes falling. But if you're aware of it and you can relax the tension in it, then that pattern unwinds. I think that's enough for me. So, thoughts, responses. I have this fantasy sometime that we ought to do a beauty contest with everybody bring their favorite hindrance. So what are some of your favorite hindrances or questions or responses? Or let's talk.
I guess going back to the seven R's.
Yeah.
So I guess my interpretation of what you described is like, say, you know, it's kind of an interpersonal issue, or, you know, maybe an issue with somebody at work, mm-hmm. and something that kind of keeps coming up over and over again, maybe because of the dynamics between you and this other person. Like, is there a way to respond? You know, in a way, it sounded like you were saying, like, if you kind of go through the seven R's, what you're likely to find is that, you know, you don't, you know, that kind of desire to kind of fight back or, like, have the last word or to say something really comes out of a place of ego or a place, you know, that
right.
kind of crossed intentions. But is there a way to respond, you know, in that type of situation, or to say something that could be constructive, or
sure, yeah.
And how
yeah.
do you figure out what that is?
Well, in the conditioned world, there are infinite number of possibilities, basically. And so, what we want to do, you know, what you're talking about is how do you come to a wise, skillful response?
Mm-hmm.
And so all I'm suggesting with the seven R's is that if you recognize the situation, including recognizing what gets caught inside you, it takes two to tango, you know, so something gets stirred. And it can be a horror show, you know, because as your awareness gets stronger, you know, we see where we're caught before the awareness is strong enough to know what to do about it. And so you get to look at all this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But as awareness builds, so you recognize and you release it in the sense of just not holding onto it or pushing it away, and relax and smile. And that, so you've brought a little bit of lightness into your mind heart.
Mm-hmm.
And that is more likely to intuitively come up with a creative, wise response. You know, unfortunately, there's no place where you can write it and push a button.
Yeah.
This is the answer to the situation. Because there are just too many nuances. But what we're trying to do with this is find some way to tap into our inherent wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
It's where we start with our Buddha nature. That the mind that is clear of tension just sees to the heart of the situation.
Mm-hmm.
Right? When we think of a wise person, that's what it is. It's not that they're clever, and they may be, but that's not what it is. It's that ability just to see to the heart of the situation. And it takes, you know, a kind of an open clarity to do that. And And then you reflect on it and you respond, and of course, but you have no control over what the other person is actually going to do. You're kind of just taking the best shot. Mm-hmm. And that's where that repeats. So you come back and look at it again. Mm-hmm.
Doug, I know in practice you always encourage us to actually physically smile, but
yes.
Smile on your face. But I can see in an interpersonal situation, the smile on your face may not be, well, it may be calming to you. And
it could be misconstrued.
That, absolutely. So are there some situations where one should just smile metaphorically?
Yes.
In other words, you need to do the physical smile.
Yeah, no, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, because what we're trying to do, amongst other things, is to as open out our social intelligence, and there are some situations where, you know, smiling can be quite, you know, disarming and open the whole things up, and other situations where it might be infuriating to somebody. And then if you are aware that it might be infuriating and you smile anyway, then. You know, so what's going on underneath there? There may be something that's, you know, trying to get him. Who knows? But yeah, that fourth step is really about invoking a lighter, brighter, clearer awareness. And smiling is just one tangible tool. And as somebody who's chronically depressed, you know, for the first 40 years of my life. You know, the smiling and re-smiling, so I didn't relate to that at all. And I was actually very resistant when I first came upon this. In fact, I talk about it in my book. When I first came across these 6 hours, it sounded to me like a Burma Shave commercial. but the way that they're put together is they're all something that you can do. And so you can't force yourself to feel better, but you can bring that in. And that's on the cushion when you out of a social situation, yeah, that has to be adapted.
Can you talk a little bit more about the proper attitude to bring to states that feel frightening or overwhelming or that seem to create mindlessness rather than mindfulness?
Yeah.
I mean, what I want is the magic button or a trick. But
I'll give you the magic button.
Oh, good.
just get enlightened. That's easy. So the first shot at this, you know, is the 6 R's. So, and what happens when you first start it is they're separate steps, and then they all begin to blend together, and you realize it's actually just one attitude. And then when the mind gets very clear, and you start to experience that unconditioned awareness, what you begin to see is that unconditioned awareness from one angle, you know, recognizes, it's just clear about what's going on. You look at it from another angle, it releases. From another angle, it's deeply relaxed. From another angle, it's luminous. And so what these separate things, but that clear awareness is not a whole bunch of different pieces. It is just one organic energy field. And so this is actually evoking that. So that's the first thing to do that. And the other thing is that there are some situations that are just stimulate us so much that you can try to do that, and it just doesn't work. You know, that something is just too deeply embedded. And it actually is not particularly helpful, you know, to sit there and to continually to engage in a situation when you're just lost in a rage or frightened or overwhelmed or something like that. And so you work with it a little bit, and if you're really stuck, then the next thing you want to do is anything. You really need to put a priority on anything you can do to allow the mind to quiet down, which may be all kinds of things, you know, leaving leaving the situation, watching funny movies, I don't, you know, whatever it is. Anything to help dissipate that. And then the trick is that as the mind does quiet down a little bit, then from that quieter space, then you may want to come back, you know, and put your toe back in the water. What happens is a lot of people will find those and say, I'm glad I'm done with that one. But I haven't actually worked it through, so it's going to come back and hit us. But what we're after ideally is to be able to look at what comes up from this wholesome mind that is released, relaxed, open, luminous, quiet. And if we can't, then we want to do things to get there. It's part of the difference between Eastern psychology and the Western psychology. Eastern psychology looks at the problems and the situations and tries to work those out first. Western psychology really looks at the quality of the awareness. And if you get the quality of awareness into a healthy place and bring that to bear in the situation, then we just have more wisdom. And they're both valuable in their different circumstances. The Western psychology is probably a little more skilled at dealing with situations where we're just overwhelmed. But as you sort of work that through, and then you're less concerned with surviving, more concerned with thriving, then looking at the mind states and stuff becomes really the work that has to be done.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Are the 7 hours more for your walking around day, and the 6 hours are for more your standard meditation?
Right. Yeah, and I underline that there's kind of subtle there. Is they're the same except for the ones that are underlined. So you take the 6 hours, there's a return. Because in meditation, situation comes up in your mind. When you're meditating, there's nothing to be done about it. You just see it. But out in life, you do want to bring that back to reflect on the situation and then respond to it from that clear reflection. And, you know, maybe the risk is stating the obvious. There's sometimes situations that are unfolding so rapidly that you don't have the luxury of spending a lot of time on this. But it's even the intention to do that a little bit actually helps. You know, you just even notice. So what happens when we get stimulated is that the way that our systems are operated is pushes all our awareness out there. And we lose track of what's going on. And you just think about them in evolutionary terms. The ones who are very mellow and with themselves and the trees. And the guy that was freaked out when there's any threat coming along. Well, guess whose DNA we got? You know, the one who was really mellow was more likely to get eaten. And the difficulty today, of course, is that now we're on the top of the food chain. And those same reflexes that kept us, allowed us to survive when we were marginal species, really are disastrous, you know, with the amount of control that we have. So looking at this stuff and allowing, you know, getting a sense of being able to see the qualities of our mind, heart, and allowing those to soften is really, really critical. I mean, I think for our survival as a species.
So if soften started with an R, you could put it right after the the reflect.
Soften is a synonym for relax. In some ways, I like it more because relax has got the R and the L and the X. While soften, it just kind of feels more, you know, relaxed, soften. I like soften. Maybe I'll change them all to S's. So we're just have a minute or two left before the gong rings and we all turn back into pumpkins or whatever. Any more questions or reflections? So let's just take a moment here. I don't know if I said this before, but I like my wife a little more when she comes home from her yoga class. And she likes me a little bit more when I come back from a meditation. So I just say that to just point to what's obvious, is that when we're doing this practice, it may seem like we're doing it for ourselves, but it actually really benefits the people around us. And we benefit from their practice. We are not these isolated, separate selves that our minds get kind of drunk and confused on. So to close here, I'd like to, for us just to spend a moment to sense that relatedness. You can almost feel it tangibly amongst all of us here, and then a little bit thinner as it goes out to other people that you're close to in your life. And maybe even fainter, but actually still there. There are those relationships with all beings everywhere, because we're all on this blue-green planet. So sensing that interrelatedness and just sending out through those, all those connections. May all beings be happy. May all beings know their true nature. May all beings befriend their demons. May all beings take themselves lightly. For the sake of our well-being and our family's well-being and our community's well-being and the well-being of the planet, may we all have a light, healthy sense of humor. May we all know ease. May it be so. Thank you all for your practice.